It's a series of six lessons in the case for creation. And this morning we're going to look at the model plausibility. As various authors, both evolutionists and creationists have observed, there's only two possible origins for this universe, for our world. One or other of these two philosophies must be true because they are contradictory in their elemental suppositions. The first is the concept of evolution, the model that presents the universe as being self-contained. The other is the concept of creation, the model that presents the universe as not self-contained. In both the evolution and creation may be referred to as properly as scientific models, since both may be used to explain and predict scientific facts. That's putting it one way. Another way of putting it, and you have to slide both of them into the same category, is that neither one of them have to do with science. Just as our knowledge of the existence of George Washington hasn't got a thing to do with science. Is it a fact? Yes. But it's more of a historical reality. It's something you can't stuff into a test tube and present to somebody as proof. But you can present various fruits, evidence to show that George Washington existed. But we're not going to go that way. We'll just, okay, in the school systems, they want to look at this as science, okay? If evolution is science, although it is a historical event if it ever occurred, because they haven't been able to reduplicate it. Okay? It's not science. Okay? But if they want to put it as science in our classrooms, then let's put the creation model in also and see which one better attests to how we got here. The model that fits the available scientific data is said to be the one that has the highest degree of probability. That is, just mount up the evidence and see which one holds more. In this series of lessons, we're going to be looking at the laws of cause and effect. That'll be next Sunday. Also, biogenesis, genetics, probability, and the fossil record to show that the creation model fits the scientific data and the model of evolution does not. But first, we'll start in this lesson with the plausibility of whichever model you want to look at. What are the options? Albert Einstein once said that scientists are possessed by the sense of universal causation. That is, we do believe in cause and effect. I mean, that is what grips scientists more than anything else. Causality confirms that every material effect has an adequate antecedent cause. That is, if you see something going on, something caused it. That is a law. That is an observation. That's common sense. You know, if suddenly we saw a ball fall, thrown through this auditorium in one window, out the other, nobody would say that that ball got up on its own and decided to do that. We would know intuitively that somebody threw the ball. Something caused whatever effect we saw. The basic question then is this: can the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the origin of new life forms best be accounted for on the basis of non-intelligent, random chance, and accidental processes? Or are these phenomena best accounted for on the basis of a creator capable of producing the complex, ordered, information-relating processes we see around us? The universe exists. It's an effect. Therefore, it must be explained in some fashion. That is, how did it get there? However, there are only three ways to account for it. One, the universe is eternal. It's always been here. It's always been doing what it's been doing. In the past, it's always done that. In the future, it'll continue to do that. One alternative is that it's not eternal. Rather, it created itself from nothing. At one point, there was no universe, and suddenly, or gradually, or randomly, it kind of came into being from absolutely nothing. Or three, the universe is not eternal. It was created by something or someone outside and superior to itself. Those are your only three choices. So we're going to take them one by one. The first one, the universe is eternal, nobody agrees with anymore. Creationist or scientist, evolutionist. Is the universe eternal? There is no doubt that eternal universe is the most comfortable position to evolutionists because it requires no explanation of a beginning or an end. If it's always been this way, why explain it? It'll continue being this way. In fact, to avoid this problem, Dr. Fred Hoyle suggested that the best way to try to explain an expanding eternal universe was to suggest that at points in space called neutrons, hydrogen was coming into existence out of nothing. That is like just new cells forming, you know, who knows from where, you know, according to him, nowhere. They just came into being and they started creating things around them. In the book, Until the Sun Dies, astronomer Robert Jastrow wrote that the proposal for the creation of matter out of nothing possesses a strong appeal to the scientists, since it permits him to contemplate a universe without beginning or without end. You don't have to come up with any explanations. However, Jastrow, who is not a creationist, went on to say, but these attempts have not succeeded. And most astronomers have come to the conclusion that they live in an exploding world. In his book, God and the Astronomers, he explains why. Three lines of evidence. The motion of the galaxies, that is the spin and everything that even solar systems have, and the motion within them. The laws of thermodynamics, which we'll look at shortly, and the life story of the stars. We can see them be born and we can see them die. Point to one conclusion. All indicated that the universe has a beginning. And then he adds, modern science denies any eternal existence to the universe, either in the past or in the future. It wasn't always here, and it isn't always going to be here. That they're starting to conclude. Did the universe then create itself out of nothing? First, of course, it must be stressed that according to the first law of thermodynamics, these are the laws the scientists came up with, matter is incapable of creating itself. That is a law. Creation goes against the law. Physicist George Davis declared, no material thing can create itself. Dr. Davis added that this statement cannot be logically attacked on the basis of any knowledge available to us. So what are evolutionists using as evidence against creation? However, Anthony Kinney, a British evolutionist, suggests in his book, Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas, that something actually came from nothing. In a 1984 issue of Scientific American, an article on inflationary universe, he stated that from a historical point of view, probably the most revolutionary aspect of the inflationary model is the notion that all the matter and energy in the observable universe may have emerged from almost nothing. Emphasis mine. Such a concept, however, is met with serious opposition from within the scientific establishment. Ralph Essling wrote a stinging rebuke in the 1994 edition of the Skeptical Inquirer. And so he said, they conjure us an entire cosmos, or myriads of cosmoses, suddenly, inexplicably, causelessly leaping into being out of nothing whatsoever for no reason at all. This universe possesses the interesting attributes of infinite temperature, infinite density, infinitesimal volume, a rather gripping state of affairs, as well as something of a sudden dramatic change from nothing whatsoever. The renowned British astrophysicist Stephen Hawking wrote, "To my personal opinion, the new inflationary model is now dead as a scientific theory." Why? There's no proof for it. No laws of science that support it. In his book, Not a Chance, R.C. Sproul wrote, "For something to bring itself into being, it must have the power of being within itself. It must at least have enough causal power to cause its own beginning. It would have to have the causal power of being before it was. It would have to have the power of being before it had any being with which to exercise the power." You didn't follow all that. That cup of water to create itself. He's saying there had to be something inside of that that it would want to cause itself to be. Okay. Which means that causation, that wanting and intent, had to be before the cup of water. So you have a willingness and intent by nothing. It has a consciousness of wanting to be a cup of water. But before that consciousness could come about, there had to be before it a consciousness that it wanted to have a consciousness in order to create the cup of water, or to create itself as a cup of water. And you could follow that on ad infinitum. You can't have nothing, even an intent, without having something caused it, even if it's an intent causing an intent causing an intent. Wherever you slice it, you got to run into something. That's two models down. What about the last? I got tired of messing with the lavalier. Last thing Mike told me was, well, don't turn your head that way because they can't hear you. Is the universe the result of creation? Can you hear me? Okay. If the universe had a beginning, it either had a cause or it did not have a cause. Take your pick. Okay. One thing we know, it is correct, both scientifically and philosophically, to acknowledge that the universe had an adequate antecedent cause. That the word antecedent kind of throws you, that means it just had something had to be there before it. Okay. The cause-effect principle states that wherever there is a material effect, there must be an adequate antecedent cause. We're going to develop, or devote a whole lesson on this next time. Okay. It goes back to our ball going through this room. If there is something that's an effect, something had to cause it. The two go together. Further indicated, however, is the fact that no effect can be qualitatively superior to or quantitatively greater than its cause. Put that another way. In physics, I remember a demonstration. Too bad I haven't got something to drop here. Even if this was a ball, and you let it go, it would not bounce higher than the position from where you let it go. It had all the kinetic and potential energy into it. Even if you threw it and the ball bounced higher, it would not have more energy than what I could generate by my arm. No effect is going to have something greater than what caused it. Since it apparent that the universe was created by something or someone, A, that existed before it, such as some eternal, uncaused first cause, or B, that is, in one way, whatever caused it, has it always been here as a cause, like God? Yeah. Or B, superior to it, that is, as you look at the universe, anything that created it had to be more powerful than all the exploding suns and galaxies there are in this universe. Think about that for a moment. As powerful as our little sun is that drives a world, most of the stars we look in the sky are a lot bigger and more powerful than our sun. When you take all the stars in all the galaxies in the whole universe and you add all their blasting power together, all the energy that's contained in each one of them, all that power still does not equal the power of God. C, has to be of a different nature since the finite, dependent universe of matter is unable to explain itself. It needed something greater than itself to explain it. If there ever had been a time when absolutely nothing existed, then there would still be nothing now. Nothing produces nothing. Since the time we've been here, has anyone seen that cup of water make another cup of water like itself? Have you ever seen any inanimate object make something else? Have you even seen something that's made already move without something moving it? A moment ago, you saw that cup move because I moved it. Before that time, that cup didn't creep off by itself. That's observable. That's something we see every day. Now, we can see intelligent life forms creating things on a daily basis, making things, inventing things. We see minds, in action, constantly building and producing other things. But we never seen an inanimate object doing that. Doesn't it sound more logical out of the three models that there is a creative mind behind the creation of the universe in setting things in order to do things as they're supposed to? Since something does exist, it must follow logically that something has existed forever. Everything that exists can be satisfied as or classified as either matter or mind. There's no third alternative, not according to modern physics. Therefore, either matter or mind is eternal. Since it is scientifically proven that matter is not eternal, then it is the mind that's eternal. As Christians, we believe that. Your spirit, your mind, is going to exist after this life, after your material body goes. Your spirit, your thinking process, all that will continue. That's the way God explains it over and over again in different ways. I mean, just take the one example of Lazarus and the rich man. The rich man was in torment, and a lot of things were still bothering him, and he was communicating with Abraham. His mind existed on beyond his body. In the past, Atheistic evolutionists suggested that the mind was nothing more than a function of the brain, which is matter. And that's prevalent thinking. Anybody that's ever watched Star Trek, you know, believes that if you think they're going to come up with a transporter beam in the near future. That all you have to do is tear down the human body and reassemble it over there, and it's going to assemble perfectly without having transferred the mind or the spirit with it, which you find is a very detailed and scientific way to kill the human body. However, this is no longer credible scientifically due in large part to the experiments of Australian physiologist Sir John Eccles. Dr. Eccles, who won the Nobel Prize for his discoveries relating to the neural synapses within the brain, documented that the mind is more than merely physical. Now they got scientific evidence that we're more than just a composition of molecules. He showed that the supplementary motor area of the brain can be fired by mere intention to do something without the motor cortex operating, that is, that which controls the muscle movements. Some way he showed that all these things are fired in the brain without anything physically moving first. Intent motivates the movement of your body. Try it. Does your body do, unless you're a little bit spastic like I am, when you're at rest, you're at rest. You don't want to move. The bed felt very warm this morning and comfortable. Did anybody just pop out and say, yeah, I want to get on the cruel world, or did you just want to stay in bed? What got you moving? Some sort of reasoning, some intent, something that said that, yeah, I got to get up. I mean, this does what I want it to because I want it to. It's my intent that makes everything move. It is my will. The same with the universe. It's God's will. He causes the grass to grow. He causes the rain to fall. Look through an explanation in the prophets. And why does prayer work? Because God's behind it all. He's the will. A cause can communicate to its effect only what it has to communicate. If our mind or ability to know is received, then there must be a mind, God, that gave it. You don't get something from nothing. How can something inanimate create a consciousness, a sense of self, a will? How can it come up with even aesthetic qualities? You know, have you ever wondered why, as you walk out, you know, in the end of the day and look at the sunset, it doesn't make you vomit? Most people go, oh, what a beautiful sunset. Did you ever see anybody go, oh, you know? You got to look it through my eyes sometimes. You know, I'm partially blind. The wife goes down and goes, oh, aren't those colors beautiful? And I see a hunk of mud laying out there. But still doesn't make me sick to my stomach. There are beautiful things even in my eyes. Where does that aesthetic quality come from? That ability to appreciate things. The ability to like things. The ability to love. It could only get into us by something that has that capacity, at least equal with our own, and in all probability, far greater. There's too much about our world we cannot know on our own. We cannot know by a scientific process. You cannot measure the ability to reason or to think. We really don't even know what an IQ test measures. Ask the guy who invented it, you know. It's an IQ. And the guy who invented it said, it's what my test measures. I wouldn't go by it if I were you. You know, don't drop a class or, you know, a graduation ceremony because somebody said you had a low IQ. It really doesn't make that much difference. We really don't know what it is. It's too adaptable to too many things. But whatever it is, we know we wouldn't have it unless God gave it to us. Because that glass of water is not going to give it to you. And that's just logical. And that's rational. You don't believe me? You ask most scientists why they believe in evolution. They'll say, because it's been proven. Now, what I'm getting from is the book, Implications of Evolution, written by a man who sits on the board of a very prestigious college and university in England. And he's on the board of directors that has these young scientists coming in, you know, to test for their degrees. And he asks them, why do you believe in evolution? And he said, their answer is, because Darwin proved it. And he goes, oh, really? In fact, what he says, to believe in evolution almost requires greater faith than the Christian to believe in his God. At least Christianity doesn't defy science as evolution does. And as for Mr. Darwin, in his own autobiography, he wrote, when I let my mind, and I'm paraphrasing, go to its logical consequences, I find God at the end of it. I mean, any way you want to slide evolution, if you're going with a first cause like we've been talking about, between matter always being in an intelligent designer, which seems more sensible? To Darwin, it was an intelligent designer. Or if you let evolution climb through getting better and better, you know, more adaptable, whatever, what do you find at, you know, getting people getting smarter, stronger, whatever? Eventually, you're going to find God at the end of that. I mean, if this can make me, can I eventually evolve into God? According to evolution? I mean, that's the problem that Darwin ran into. What was his solution? Nix the reason. Really. He said, if I came from things that do not have the power to reason, or I doubt their ability to reason totally, I got to doubt my own ability to reason fully. That's the way he explained it. Of the two models, which seems more plausible? Or just of the two models, which would you prefer to accept? Do you like to think of yourself as something that crawled out of the slime and has really no ability to appreciate the things around them, no reasoning powers, no higher instincts, no way to overcome the madness and the evil that's around us? Or would you prefer to believe, as we read in Genesis, that we are the creation of God in his image and accountable to each other for the things we do? And we can see order and design all around us, and things like caring and love and appreciation. Which world do you want to live in? The invitation's extended. Won't you come as we stand and sing?